He gave Barkhorn the signal to take over. Barkhorn was so busy laughing, he flew smoothly, like a natural pilot. Franz enjoyed being a flight instructor. Every morning, when he walked into his classroom, he oversaw four instructors, each of whom looked after four students. The Air Force let him remain a civilian. They paid him his airline salary, which was the equivalent to a major's wages, and gave him a major's authority. Franz's final report determined if a cadet earned his wings, and the higher Franz ranked a cadet, the more choice a young pilot would have in picking his next assignment to further training in either single or multi-engine aircraft. All the cadets vied for single-engine training because that meant fighters, whereas multi-engine aircraft could be bombers, transports, or reconnaissance planes. Franz ultimately gave Barkhorn good scores, and the young pilot qualified for single-engine school. The only thing Franz lacked in his new role was rank and the respect that came with it, because he was a civilian. Although most of his pupils were cadets who would be officers one day, some of Franz's students were officers who had been in the military for years and now had decided to become pilots. They presented Franz's biggest challenge. One day, Franz gave a class in navigation. All the while, a captain sat in the back of the room and read a newspaper, ignoring Franz. Franz had had enough. "Captain," he said, "would you come to the front and read the newspaper out loud, so we'll all know what's going on?" The captain folded his newspaper and walked up to Franz in front of the others. "You have no right to give me orders," the officer said. "You're just a civilian." Franz felt the back of his neck grow hot. He closed the class, dismissed the pupils, and went straight to the general who ran the school. The general was a hefty fellow and liked Franz because Franz flew him to Munich every Friday so the general could see his doctor. Franz explained the problem with his disrespectful captain. "Get your logbook," the general told Franz. "Now write private next to your name." Franz did so and looked at the general, confused. "I'll handle your enlistment papers personally," the general said. "You're now officially a member of the Air Force." Franz opened his mouth, but was at a loss for words. "As for the unruly captain," the general said, "now you can send him packing." Franz did, and expelled the captain from the school. The next day, the captain tracked down Franz to protest his expulsion. He fumed that a private had cast him out and would keep him from ever becoming a pilot. Franz now wore the blue uniform of a Luftwaffe enlisted man, with a tent cap atop his head, red collar tabs on his tunic, a silver belt buckle, and black boots. "If you, as a captain, do not know how to behave," Franz said, "how could we have made you into a good pilot?" The captain cursed Franz as he hauled his bags away from the school. Franz found that his new rank solved some problems, but being a private only got him so far. A few weeks later, while flying home from the doctor in Munich, the general asked Franz how he liked being a private. Franz said it helped, but so many of his students were majors and captains that they still looked down on him. The general was in a good mood, so, in the air, he promoted Franz to corporal. In early 1939, the cadet who would become Franz's most cherished student waited for him as Franz climbed from his plane after a lesson. Franz was shocked to see his older brother, August, standing before him on the tarmac. Franz knew August had enlisted in the Air Force against their mother's wishes, but the odds that he would be sent to train under Franz seemed incredible. Franz had not seen August since his brother had left for boot camp. August was on the path to become an officer. August had qualified for officer status, unlike Franz, who had not finished his university degree and would have to climb the ranks. The German Air Force was not as rank-conscious as other air forces, so even low-ranking airmen and corporals could be fighter pilots. He had already soloed with ease and passed Stage A, He would now spend 8 months under Franz's tutelage to earn his wings. Franz knew why August had joined. All young men were being drafted into the military, and August knew that by enlisting first, he could pick the branch of service he wanted. August had a lot to lose. He was engaged to the niece of a cardinal, a match their mother had made. August had his education, his job as a high school teacher, his family, his church, and his freedom. "Why risk everything?" Franz had asked him. August had said he was certain a war was coming, and he would be drafted. If he had to fight, he preferred to fly. To be impartial, Franz could have assigned August to another instructor. But Franz did not care what the other cadets whispered. He was burdened by the thought that his brother's survival in combat one day could hinge on his training. So Franz picked August as one of his personal students. For months, Franz taught August aerobatics, high-altitude flying, and emergency procedures. As their training period wound down, August told Franz that he planned to apply for a twin-engine assignment to fly aircraft that allowed a pilot to enjoy the ride instead of the diving and twisting dogfights of fighter pilots. Franz knew that August lacked the killer instinct a fighter pilot needed, but this was a good quality in Franz's eyes. With only weeks remaining that they could be together, Franz gave August extra lessons after class to hone skills a bomber pilot would need. Skills such as distance flying, night flying, and flying blind, by instruments only. Franz trained August harder than any other instructor would have. He demanded perfection. August earned a week-long vacation prior to his final exams. He decided to go home to spend time with his fiancée. It was a Friday, and that morning Franz had sent him on a long-distance training hop where August had followed his map from airfield to airfield. At each point he was to land and get his logbook stamped by the duty officer in the tower as proof. When August reported back to Franz that evening, along with the other students, Franz found that only one pilot was missing a stamp, his brother. August explained that he could not find the duty officer and left without the stamp. Franz knew his brother had been in a hurry. August admitted this was true.
"Hurrying in an airplane can get you killed," Franz told him.
In front of the other cadets, Franz tore up August's holiday papers and canceled his leave. August was shocked and angry. Franz told his brother to go prepare an airplane for more training. August obeyed and left Franz's office sulking. The brothers took to the skies, Franz in front, August behind, to practice August's least favorite mission, flying blind. Soon after takeoff, Franz ordered August under the hood. August pulled a handle and a black cloth covered his canopy, locking him into a cockpit lit only by instruments. Franz flew the plane for a while to disorient August. Then he shouted orders between cockpits and told August which course to steer and for how long. Franz knew that August had no idea where he was going. An hour and a half later, Franz told August he was taking control of the plane. August asked to remove the hood, which was customary, but Franz denied the request. Franz landed the craft, taxied to a stop, and only then told August he could remove the hood. August started to give Franz a piece of his mind for keeping him in the dark for so long, but he stopped mid-sentence. Waiting for him by a hangar on the tarmac was his fiancée. August immediately recognized the airport, Regensburg. They weren't back at Dresden. They were home. August's fiancée giggled at the shock on his face. She knew what Franz had done.
"I had called his girlfriend, his fiancée, and told her, 'We're coming home.'"
Franz would remember. August embraced his fiancée and tried to rustle Franz's hair as Franz squirmed away. They were like boys again. During their week-long holiday, the brothers stayed at their boyhood home on a quiet street in Hamburg. While looking for August one afternoon, Franz wandered into his brother's bedroom. There, on August's desk, Franz found a stack of letters. Franz picked one up and read it. His hands began to tremble. The letter was a copy of With Burning Concern, the Vatican's secretly composed message to all of Germany's Catholics. On Palm Sunday 1937, the letter had been read by every priest, bishop, and cardinal across Germany to their congregations, and 300,000 copies had been disseminated. Drafted by Munich's Cardinal von Faulhaber and Pope Pius XI, it told German Catholics in carefully veiled terms that National Socialism was an evil religion based on racism that stood contrary to the Church's teachings and every man's right to equality. It made reference to an insane and arrogant prophet without naming Hitler. When Hitler found out about the letter, he and the party roared in backlash, outlawing the letter and seizing monks, priests, and any press shops that had printed it. Franz's mind raced as he set down the letter. Franz wanted to burn it and the others. He wanted to run. Instead, he waited on the front steps for August to return home. Franz suspected the letters really belonged to August's fiancée, the cardinal's niece. The Catholic clergy of Germany were known enemies of the party, thanks to their sermons that reviled Hitler, his Gestapo secret police, and the early crimes of the Third Reich. Franz was certain that his brother's fiancée, via her uncle, was dragging his brother into something dangerous, opposition. When August returned, Franz confronted him, asking him what he was doing with such dangerous literature. August brushed Franz off and said he had found the letters and kept them as a curiosity. Franz reminded August that the letters were dangerous.
"Do you want to wind up in Dachau?"
Franz asked him. August scowled. They both knew of Dachau and the concentration camps that existed to concentrate in one place any Germans who had angered the party. The camps were common knowledge in most German households. The party wanted the camps to be known as a deterrent, and had publicized Dachau as their model camp. The party had built Dachau in 1933. Any German, regardless of religion or background, could be labeled a political enemy and imprisoned there. A year after seizing power, in 1934, the party had passed a law that made a person's private or public criticism of the party a crime worthy of a camp sentence. The party went to great lengths to show their fellow Germans and the world that Dachau was a civilized camp. The party's private security force, the SS, ran the camps and even invited Red Cross representatives and American prison wardens to tour Dachau. The international visitors walked away impressed with what they saw. Well-fed prisoners who whistled as they marched to work details, tidy barracks, flower beds, and even a store where the prisoners could purchase tinned food. When the prisoners were released, the SS gave them back their possessions. This was the image of a concentration camp that the party had fed Franz, August, their fellow Germans, and the world during the 1930s. The camps were so well publicized that German mothers used to tell their children that if they were bad, they would be taken away to Dachau. The German civilians weren't the only ones misled about the camps. In a 1937 speech to the German army, SS leader Heinrich Himmler told them how the prisoners were treated.
"The training of men is carried out in these camps in an orderly way. They live in clean huts. Only Germans are capable of such an accomplishment. No other nation would be as humane. Clothes are changed frequently. The men are trained to wash twice a day and to use a toothbrush, something which the majority have never known before."
A later chapter will discuss when and how Franz would learn the truth about what was really happening in the camps. Seeing Franz's turmoil, August promised to dispose of the letters. Franz did not fault August for opposing Hitler. Franz knew their parents opposed Hitler, too. They always said that Hitler was not their leader. In 1933, they had voted for the BVP, the Bavarian People's Party, the Catholic Party that had won 1 million votes, but still fell far short of the National Socialists' 44%. As a teenager, Franz had paid little attention to the 1933 election. He was apathetic about politics and not initially alarmed by the National Socialists' victory. Franz would remember,
"Being Catholic and a well-educated family, we just did not buy into the propaganda.
My family was anti-Nazi from the early days. I must admit that I was also very indifferent and thought it was all bullshit, to be honest. But now, as a 24-year-old man in spring 1939, Franz had come to think of the party differently than he had as a boy in 1933. He had come to realize that the party had turned Germany itself into a concentration camp. There were no elections, no freedom of press, no freedom of speech, no freedom to travel, no freedom to choose to serve in the military, no freedom to change things. In the days when possessing an outlawed letter could earn someone a sentence in a camp, the best Franz knew was to stay out of the line of fire, so neither he nor his brother would end up in Dachau. That summer, Franz pinned the wings on August's uniform when he graduated from flight school. August received his wings in time to wear them when he married his fiancée shortly thereafter. During the wedding ceremony, Franz could not bring himself to look upon his new sister-in-law with much affection. He was still worried. After the wedding, August went to twin engine school, the path of a bomber pilot, and Franz returned to instructing. That autumn 1939, Franz's cadets approached him in the mess hall one morning, waving newspapers in their hands. The big, gothic headlines declared, "War with Poland." The young cadets were smiling and shouting. They wanted Franz's opinion. Would their training be hurried so they could get into the war? Franz did not share their glee. War was the last thing he wanted. But in the minds of the flight school cadets, the world's affairs were simple. According to the German papers, the Poles had threatened German farmers on the shared border. Polish troops had attacked a German radio station on the border in order to transmit slander against the Germans, and Hitler had no choice but to declare war. The cadets thought Hitler was right, just like they had reasoned that Germany's other neighbors, Czechoslovakia and Austria, had wanted to become part of the new German Empire. The annexation of those countries, that year and the year prior, had been bloodless. In reality, the Austrians and Czechs had no choice. Germany had been militarily rebuilt and seemed unstoppable, and the Polish troops who had raided the German radio station were actually German commandos wearing Polish uniforms. Hitler had ordered this. He wanted a war of expansion, and he lied to his own people to get it. What neither Franz nor any of the cadets could fathom was that Hitler had knowingly picked a fight with much of the rest of Europe, dragging Germany into a repeat of their father's war. Britain and France had pledged that if Poland was ever attacked, their empires would fight on the Polish side. Hitler attacked Poland anyway. His gamble would eventually cost the lives of more than 4 million German soldiers and more than 1 million civilians. World War II had officially begun. 1 year later, mid-October 1940. Franz worked alone at his desk in an empty classroom. His instructors were out, each training students for war. German troops now occupied all of Europe, from Poland to France, and had beaten the English back to their island. The Battle of Britain, as the British called it, was over. The battle had taken place late that summer when the Germans had tried to destroy the British Royal Air Force, RAF, in the sky, and to bomb their airfields on the ground. But before the German Air Force could succeed, a grievous mistake shook their focus. During a night raid, a German bomber mistakenly missed its target, an oil depot east of London, and bombed several homes on London's East End neighborhood. Hitler had given orders that British cities were not to be bombed. But a week later, another German bomber hit homes again. In response, the British sent bombers to attack Berlin, a raid that also missed its military targets and bombed the city's civilians. In a speech, Hitler warned the British to stop their attacks on German cities, but it was too late. Both sides had stepped over the line. Cities and civilians soon became fair game. From then on, both sides bombed each other's cities at night and called one another terror bombers. Franz knew that August was on the front lines, flying a Ju-88 bomber, a fast twin-engine plane with a four-man crew. August and his crew had been assigned to Squadron KG-806 and were based in Caen, France, from where they bombed England at night. At first, their targets were airfields and docks. Then, they were ordered to bomb cities. France knew August would not have liked this, but would have had no choice. France looked up in surprise when he heard the door to his classroom open slowly. The cadets usually kicked it open in glee after a mission. France saw Father Joseph standing in the doorway. The priest was dressed in civilian attire, but still wore his large wooden cross. France moved toward him, his heart racing. Then he stopped. Father Joseph was not smiling. "Sit down, France," he said. France stayed standing, his feet frozen. Father Joseph was his father's best friend. France assumed something must have happened to his father. The priest's eyes welled with tears. France's legs became wobbly, as if his body knew the answer even before his mind made the suggestion. Father Joseph rushed to him and guided him into a seat among the many empty desks. "August is with God," he said. France would not allow Father Joseph to provide him with any details until the following day, when he was able to control his emotions. Father Joseph told Franz that August had crashed on takeoff for a night mission to London several days prior, on October 10th. August and his entire crew had been killed. The reason for the crash was unknown. It had happened at night, and all witnesses saw was a flash. There would be no funeral. August was already buried in Caen, France. Father Joseph gave Franz a letter written by August's commanding officer that said that August had died a hero. Franz tossed the letter aside. Franz blamed himself for August's crash. He had trained him. "What could I have missed?" He blamed the people who had built August's plane. Had they made a mistake? He blamed the war. He had believed what Hitler said, that Germany had attacked Poland in self-defense. Franz blamed the British. In his mind, they had turned a war between two countries into a world war. August had been flying at night, from grass airfields, in dangerous conditions, because of them. Franz's grief chilled into hate. Before he could leave to go home and console his parents, Franz reported to the general. The general offered Franz his plane, but Franz refused so that he could ride back with Father Joseph. Franz thanked the general for being good to him, but said he was resigning. The general appeared shocked. Franz was his best instructor. The general reminded Franz that he could take as much time away as he needed. When he came back, he would always have an instructor job, far from the war. "Promise me you'll think about it," the general told Franz as he walked out the door. But the more Franz thought about it, the more he knew exactly what he wanted. 4. Fire Free. 18 months later, April 7, 1942, the Libyan coastline. Low and fast, the 12 tan Messerschmitt Bf-109 fighters blasted over the white beaches of Libya. Climbing over the sea cliffs, the fighters soared above the ruins and Hellenic columns of the ancient Greek city of Apollonia. One 109, far back in formation, flew at an odd angle, banking. One wingtip pointed to earth.
"Stiegler, straighten up!"
barked the flight leader, Lieutenant Werner Schröer, across the radio. Franz righted his 109, the hottest German fighter of the day. The machine's body was sleek, except for an air filter that jutted from the side of the nose. Franz had not been so happy in ages. He watched over his shoulder as the ruins faded behind his tail. During his Lufthansa days, he had loved to explore the old world's ancient cities.
"Buy a postcard," Schröer radioed Franz.
The pilots were all rookies except for Schröer, who had flown in the desert already for a year. Schröer had 4 kills, or enemy aircraft destroyed, to his name.
Franz was now a sergeant and a full-fledged fighter pilot, having graduated from boot camp and fighter school with a promotion. With more than 4,000 hours of flight time under his belt, he could have flown transports or air-sea rescue planes, or he could have stayed an instructor forever. But he had chosen fighters and asked to be transferred to a war theater. It was no secret why. He wanted revenge. A few days earlier, he had taken possession of his war horse from the factory in Munich where it had been built. He found it there, waiting on a ramp, already painted in its desert camouflage color scheme, with its white spinner, tan body, and belly the color of a blue robin's egg. The 109 was a new F model, nicknamed the Friedrich, the fastest 109 to date. The fighter wore no identification numbers on its flanks. Franz was told they would be assigned when he reached his squadron. On its fuselage and wings, it bore the large black cross with white outline, the mark of the German Air Force. Schröer had met Franz and the other rookies after they had flown to Sicily, the island at the toe of the Italian boot. From Sicily, he had led them across the Mediterranean to Africa. From Tunisia, Schröer swung east, and the pilots flew along the coast. Having passed Apollonia, Franz saw the Green Mountains, the Al-Jabal al-Akhtar range, appear below him. The mountains were a lush anomaly in craggy northern Libya. The flight motored over the ancient Islamic city of Derna, where the sun lit the 42 minarets of the city's mosque. Turning south, Schröer steered the flight into the dry desert, with its rocks, scrub brush, and gullies. When Franz first saw the desert, he thought of the Christian knights on their crusades for the Holy Land. At fighter school, the old instructors, themselves World War I aces, had told Franz and the other rookies that the black cross on their plane's wings and fuselage was an homage to the German Teutonic Knights, whose white shields bore a black cross. "You are their descendants," they told the students. The old World War I pilots were themselves called the Old Knights, and they talked of their code. It was unwritten and unspoken. It could only be witnessed and embodied. It was a battle code of honor and chivalry. When Franz arrived in the desert, he thought their stories were just the whimsical ideals of old veterans. But there, above the sands, he would learn otherwise. Ahead, on the white horizon, Franz saw the tan tent peaks of Martuba Airfield, his new home. Entering the traffic pattern to land, Franz was aghast. Martuba looked like a sprawling, isolated campsite. It had countless center-pitched tents in clusters, like villages, no hangars, and just a small, whitewashed control tower. A handful of mud-brick blast pens housed fighters along the flight line, but most of the planes sat naked on the sand, baking in the sun. Following Schröer down, Franz landed on Martuba's sun-bleached runway, with its scars visible from bombings. Taxiing, Franz found his canopy surrounded by blowing sand kicked up from his plane's Daimler-Benz motor. He stopped when a shirtless ground crewman approached through the swirling whiteout. The crewman climbed up onto his right wing and sat on the wingtip. The crewman motioned and pointed for Franz to pull ahead. With hand signals, he guided Franz to park alongside the other new arrivals. Franz shut down his engine, unbuckled his seatbelt, and hauled himself from the cockpit. He slid off the wing, his hands stinging from its hot metal. A darkly tanned crewman took Franz's parachute. Franz stretched to work out the kinks. He removed his leather jacket and felt the blazing African sun. Around him, other fighters on the flight line had victory marks on their rudders, white vertical bars, one for each aerial kill. Franz studied the hash marks. It took 5 to make an ace. Some of the planes around him had 4 times that. Schröer approached Franz. His face was V-shaped and serious, but his eyes were friendly and shy. When he removed his cap to wipe his brow, he revealed that he was balding and looked old for being a young man. He seemed unbothered by the sun, while Franz squinted. Schröer could see Franz's wheels turning, and told him it had once taken the magic 20 victories to earn the Knight's Cross. But now, the benchmark was higher, at least 30 victories, thanks to the fighter pilots on the Eastern Front, whose high scoring against easy opponents was spoiling everyone else's dreams. Franz knew the Knight's Cross was Germany's preeminent award for valor, a medal worn around the neck inspired by the ancient Teutonic knights. Schröer told Franz it was time to check into the war. He walked to the control tower, where a few Kubelwagens, the German equivalent of jeeps, were parked. Franz grabbed his duffel from the storage compartment in his plane's fuselage and followed. The tower, Franz would learn, was only for administration. The real ground-to-air coordination happened in an underground bunker next door. Hidden by dirt and marked only by the hum of a generator, Franz saw air crew and orderlies emerge from the bunkers and shield their eyes against the sunlight. This was the headquarters of Fighter Wing 27, Jagdgeschwader 27, or JG-27, the legendary Desert Wing, romanticized in the newsreels. JG-27 had just 120 pilots at full strength. They were the primary fighter force in Africa and served a strategic mission. The Germans wanted to take the Suez Canal in Egypt away from the British. Whoever controlled the canal controlled one of only two waterways into the Mediterranean. The fighting in North Africa had already been raging for a year. It was a pushing contest. The Germans would push the British 100 or 200 miles back toward the canal, into sandy Egypt, then the British would push the Germans back the same distance into craggy Libya. The mission facing JG-27 was daunting. They were to keep the skies clear over the German army known as the Afrika Korps. Opposing JG-27 was the Desert Air Force, a mixed unit of English squadrons and those from all nations of the British Crown. The Desert Air Force outnumbered the pilots of JG-27, 5-1. Franz entered the tower. The narrow room was fitted with wooden benches. High ceilings were held in place by thick beams. Hanging on the wall was a panel of yellow metal cut from a downed British fighter. Painted on the metal was the plane's nose art, a blue shield with a curved scimitar. Franz joined the other rookies in a line, at attention, when three officers entered and stood before them to announce the new pilot's assignments. The officers wore loose tan shirts and baggy green pants. Under their arms they tucked their white crush caps, like those worn by U-boat captains. One officer, a captain, had groomed his black beard into a sharp goatee. He was Captain Ernst Mach. Franz had never seen facial hair on an officer in Germany. He saw only sternness in Mach's face. The captain barked some names from his list, and the pilots called stepped forward. Mach told the pilots that they now belonged to Squadron 2. The room turned silent. Mach singled out one of his new pilots, an airman named Helmut Beckmann, and began to address him in a loud, sarcastic voice.
"Did you manage to deliver your plane undamaged?"
"Yes, sir," Beckmann said.
"Did you land on your wheels or crash on your belly?"
"We did not encounter the enemy," Beckmann said wisely.
Franz found himself hoping Mach did not call on him.
"Are you politically inclined?"
"I was in the Air Force HJ, Hitler Youth, sir," Beckmann said.
"I'm not interested in that," Mach said. "I'm asking if you are a member of the party."
"No, sir."
"Another big plus for you,"
Mach smiled.
"Keep it up, and you'll do just fine." "Stiegler?"
a first lieutenant said calmly, looking around. Shorter and slighter than Mach, the officer seemed serenely confident. He had thick black hair, slicked back, and a square, boyish face. His narrow eyes beamed a sensitive, concerned look. The Knight's Cross dangled from his neck, over the open collar of his crumpled tan shirt. Franz took one look at the thick, black cross as it hung from a red and white ribbon, and decided that he, too, would one day wear the cross. Franz clicked his heels and began to salute, but stopped when the lieutenant thrust forward an outstretched hand and said,
"Welcome to Squadron 4. Follow me."
Franz grinned. He shouldered his bag, relieved that he was not stuck with Mach. Leaning against the doorframe, Schröer wished Franz luck. Outside the shed, the officer flopped his faded white cap on his head. He introduced himself as Lieutenant Gustav Ruddle. Franz would learn that Ruddle was from Merseburg in eastern Germany, near Poland. They were the same age. Franz joined Ruddle in his Kubelwagen for a tour of the base. An enlisted man drove, while Ruddle explained to Franz that 3 months earlier the airfield had been owned by the British, before the Desert Fox took it back for the Germans. Franz knew the Desert Fox was General Erwin Rommel, the commander of the Afrika Corps.
"Can I ask a strange question, Lieutenant?" Franz said.
Ruddle nodded.
"What was Mach getting at by asking that pilot if he was a party member?"
"Never heard someone in uniform speak so brazenly, huh?"
Ruddle said. Franz nodded. Ruddle explained the rumors that had floated since the Battle of Britain that the party was going to send political officers to infiltrate Air Force squadrons to look for dissension.
"Mach hates the thought of that, as we all do," Ruddle said.
"Let me ask you this. Are you a party member, Stiegler?"
"No,"
Franz said.
"I don't need a politician to make me go to war."
Ruddle smiled and nodded. Ruddle, Mach, and the others knew that any fighter pilot who was a party member was a rarity, and most likely a fanatic. To be a Nazi in the German Air Force, one needed to have joined the party before enlisting or being drafted, usually at a very young age. Once a man joined the Air Force, the German defense law of 1938 forbid him from party membership. This was due to a German tradition called Überparteilichkeit, or impartiality, the separation of military from politics. German civilians could join the party at any time, as could the SS and the Gestapo. But in the German Air Force, a Nazi fighter pilot was a rarity. It was Ruddle's philosophy, like Mach's, to spot such pilots right away, and to keep an eye on them. When Ruddle's driver passed a group of 109s whose cowlings sported leopard heads and the faces of spooked natives surrounded by the outline of Africa, Ruddle indicated to Franz that the planes belonged to Squadron 3, home to Germany's most famous pilot of the time, Lieutenant Hans Joachim Marsay, the 22-year-old ace known as the virtuoso of all fighter pilots. He had already destroyed more than 50 enemy planes.
"You've heard stories of him,"
Ruddle said. Franz nodded. He had read everything he could about the Star of Africa, as the newspapers called Marsay. Ruddle told Franz the whispers of Marseille's free-spirited rebelliousness were true. Once, as a joke, Marseille ran over Schröer's tent with his Kubelwagen. Another time, when passed up for a promotion, he strafed the tent area of his squadron leader. And he had crashed more than one plane into the desert by flying on the edge.
"But despite all the trouble he creates for his commanders," Ruddle said, "he is simply too good to ground."
The driver slowed the vehicle to a stop in front of a 109 marked like those around it, with a red and white crest on its cowling. Ruddle told Franz that these were the planes of their unit, second group. The crest on each plane was the logo of the city of Berlin, the unit's home city. The crest was white, with a red outline, and in the center was a painted black bear, standing, with its tongue lapping. Ruddle explained that there were three squadrons in second group. There was his squadron, Squadron 4, as well as Squadron 5 and Squadron 6. Behind the planes, Franz saw their squadron's headquarters, a wooden shack, several large tents, and a flagpole, where a flag hung limply. Ruddle opened a small door and exited the car, indicating for Franz to remain seated. He told the driver to help Franz get situated in his new home. Ruddle walked to his 109, a fighter with a yellow number 4 painted on its flanks. Franz noticed that Ruddle's fighter wore no victory marks on its tail. With Ruddle strapping in and out of earshot, Franz asked the driver, incredulous, how Ruddle could wear the Knight's Cross but not be an ace. The driver grinned at the chance to put another rookie in his place. He told Franz that Ruddle had 37 victories, some gained in Spain during their civil war, some in Poland, some in Greece, some over the Soviet Union, and the rest in the desert, including one the day before.
He's one of our best, the driver said. He just chooses not to flaunt it.
The driver clunked the Kubelwagen into gear and pulled away. In the back seat, Franz suddenly felt very stupid. 2 days later, April 9th, 1942. The sand-caked tent rustled under a blast of frigid night air. Inside the tent, Franz lay on his cot, awakened by the flapping canvas. He fished for his cigarette lighter, flicked it to life, and read his wristwatch by the dull glow of the flame. It was 4 a.m. He huddled back under his blanket, shivering. The desert was bitterly cold until the sun arose. Franz remembered that he was due on the flight line at 6 a.m. for his first mission, having flown an orientation flight at the same time the day before. The aces of JG-27 liked to break in the rookies quickly, and Franz preferred this to sitting around. Quickly, he rose and donned his tan desert regulation shirt and black leather flying jacket. Showers were only permitted every few days, as water was precious, so Franz knew not to bother. He stepped into heavy, pale blue flying trousers, with, on each thigh, a large map pocket that extended below his kneecap. He shook out his thick black leather flying boots to check for scorpions, but only sand poured out. He zipped up his boots and grabbed his rosary from a wooden crate that served as his nightstand. His mother had given Franz the rosary after his confirmation. A silver crucifix dangled from the necklace of small, rectangular black beads. Franz slid his rosary into his jacket's pocket, over his heart, and slipped out of his tent. In the pre-dawn darkness, he wandered through the Spartan tent city that was JG-27's desert home. All the tents looked alike. Locating the mess tent at last, Franz ducked inside the flaps and felt the immediate warmth of oil stoves and lively conversation as a handful of pilots ate oatmeal and drank hot coffee. Ruddle sipped his coffee in the tent corner while reviewing a battle map. Each squadron sat together, like a team. At full strength, a squadron mustered 16 pilots and planes, but quantities of each were always short due to losses. The pilots' morale remained high, however. They thought they could still win the war. After slopping his plateful of oatmeal and toast on the chow line, Franz sat down, his mess tin before him. After one bite, he was taken aback. His oatmeal tasted like dirt. His coffee tasted like sulfur. The cooks had used the usual brown water to make both. JG-27 had many Bavarians and Austrians among its pilots, so, like citizens of the same state, Franz found he could make small talk with them. Many of them had been in Africa for a year already. One of the veterans told Franz the standing joke.
A captured Tommy pilot asked his German captor, "What do you want with Africa, anyway?" The German replied, "The same thing you do." Upon further thought, both men shrugged, not knowing what that was.
The veterans roared in laughter. Franz faked a laugh. He did not understand where they were coming from, at least not yet. Franz had barely begun to eat when Ruddle stood and announced a phrase Franz would learn to dread.
Fire free!
It meant the men could smoke now, and that the mealtime was over. Everybody left the mess hall at once. Franz was the last to pick up his dishes. He went to the buffet, where a cook was cleaning up.
Listen, he said, save something for me. Otherwise, I'll starve to death here.
Ruddle waited outside for Franz.
What are you doing suited up? You don't fly until afternoon.
Franz groaned. Nervousness had made him forget that the night before Ruddle had pulled him from a dawn flight and assigned him to a 2 p.m. mission. Afternoon missions were quieter and safer because it was the hottest part of the day when few wanted to fly. Franz paced around the base for several hours. By mid-morning it was already 100 degrees, but he couldn't handle the thought of going back to his tent and simply sitting around. He kept pacing, pausing only to put a t-shirt over his face to ward off swarms of black flies. After lunch, he reported to Ruddle at the squadron shack and found him suited up to fly. Ruddle said he would personally be taking Franz on his first mission, a free hunt, where the two of them would fly into enemy territory and look for trouble. Together, they walked toward the flight line. In the west, the Green Mountains looked yellow under the blazing sun. Upon reaching his fighter, Franz saw that a white number 12 had been painted on its flank. Suddenly, his girl had a name. White 12. Rudel sat on the tire of Franz's plane, just in front of the wing, and told Franz to take a seat. Rudel looked at Franz as a father might look at a son.
"Every single time you go up, you'll be outnumbered," he said.
Franz nodded, wishing Rudel was exaggerating, but knowing better.
"Those odds may make a man want to fight dirty to survive,"
Rudel said, squeezing the bunched-up leather gloves in his hands.
"But let what I'm about to say to you act as a warning. Honor is everything here."
Franz shrugged, unsure where Rudel was going with the talk.
"What will you do, Stiegler, for instance, if you find your enemy floating in a parachute?"
"I guess I've never thought that far ahead yet,"
Franz said.
"If I ever see or hear of you shooting at a man in a parachute," Rudel said, "I will shoot you down myself."
The words stung. There was logic behind Ruddle's warning. When a pilot spared a defenseless enemy in a parachute, as was the unspoken practice in the Battle of Britain, if the enemy pilot returned to combat, he would be more apt to repeat the gesture. It was for this same reason that the British tried to treat captured German airmen well, housing them in POW castles and manors. The Germans would write home and tell of their good treatment, and hopefully the treatment of British POWs would improve in turn.
"You follow the rules of war for you, not for your enemy," Rudel said. "You fight by rules to keep your humanity."
Rudel slapped a glove against his palm. "Stick close, and we'll come home together." He hopped from the tire. The lesson was over. A ground crewman helped Franz strap into his parachute that sat on his seat in the cockpit. Shutting the square glass canopy hood, Franz felt a new sense of dread, as if he had shut his own coffin. Franz pushed the throttle forward and fired a thumbs up to two ground crewmen who spun the engine crank. The engine sputtered. The plane belched a snort of white smoke. The propeller began spinning. Height meant everything to a fighter pilot in the desert. There were few clouds to block the sun, so any time his opponent looked up, he was blinded. Franz wore sunglasses, but still held a hand over his eyes, against his flight helmet, as he flew off to Ruddle's left wing. Ruddle's plane bumped in turbulence. The Berlin Bear on its nose seemed to dance. Franz looked out over the desert beneath his wings. The ground alternated in shades of brown and tan that indicated gullies and rocky promontories. To the north lay the scrubby green coastal hills, and beyond that, the pale blue Mediterranean Sea. The Desert Air Force's American-built Curtiss P-40 fighters usually motored along at 18,000 feet, so Rudel led Franz higher, to 25,000 feet, meandering between favorite hunting spots. Franz followed Rudel. Both pilots scanned the brown earth for the enemy aircraft's reddish-tan wings. They flew over the main battlefront, marked only by smoke wisps from exploding artillery shells. The line ran southward from the ocean into the desert. As they motored east, Ruddle's voice crackled over the radio. He pointed out the British port of Tobruk to the north. Franz saw the flat, white city nestled around the ocean in the hazy distance. Tobruk was the strategic prize of North Africa, a door from which supplies and fuel could flow from the sea to the front lines.
"Indians, 12 o'clock low," Rudel said,
the code words for having spotted the enemy. Franz saw four Curtiss fighters below, gently weaving left and right in lazy S patterns as they flew on a reconnaissance mission toward the German lines. Desert Air Force planes were most likely flown by English or South African pilots, but the force also contained Australians, Canadians, New Zealanders, Scots, Irishmen, Free Poles, Free French, and even American volunteers. From far above, Franz could see the P-40's sharp red spinners and painted shark teeth with beady eyes, a frightening war paint the American Flying Tigers in China had borrowed from the Desert Air Force. Franz saw the red, yellow, and blue concentric circles on their wings that brazenly marked them as his foe. Ruddle radioed Franz and told him he was attacking and to stay close. He peeled off and dove toward the enemy. Franz followed, his heart racing. His task was dive, hit, climb, repeat. This was the fighting style of the 109, a plane that could not turn with its enemies in spiral dogfights, but could outrun and outclimb most of them. 7,000 feet below, the P-40 pilots spotted the diving 109s. Franz saw the pack of P-40s break formation and peel wildly upward, aiming their shark mouths directly at him and Ruddle. 1,000 feet passed by in a split second. The needle in Franz's altimeter whipped counterclockwise. 22,000 feet. 20,000. 18,000. Ruddle's plane obscured half of Franz's windshield as he flew just ahead of him. The P-40s seemed to swell as they climbed on their collision course. Franz had been told that going nose-to-nose with a P-40 was a fatal mistake because each carried 6 heavy 50-caliber machine guns, more potent firepower than the 109's 2 machine guns and single heavy cannon that fired from its nose. But Ruddle seemed to know otherwise. Ruddle fired first. Flames spit from the nose of his fighter. His cannon's roar startled Franz. The P-40's wings twinkled in reply. Franz knew that a combined 24 guns were now firing at him. He squeezed off a terrified, blind burst. In training, he had shot at fabric targets towed by biplanes, but never while diving toward the earth with the target racing up at him. Ruddle's shell casings whipped by his windshield like a rain of brass nails. A P-40 burst into flames. Flaming tracers from the P-40s whipped around Franz's canopy. He swore they were about to collide. Franz could take it no more. He panicked. Hauling back on the stick, he pulled his fighter into a screaming climb, up and away from the onrushing enemy. Aiming his plane's nose toward the blue, he ran for the heavens. Franz tucked his neck into his shoulders, bracing for the thud of lead on his armored headrest, but no bullets followed.
"Orido!"
Ruddle shouted over the radio. Franz knew this battle cry meant he had shot down an enemy plane and wanted Franz to visually verify its destruction. But Franz was too far away and unable to see a thing. Franz felt sick. His shoulder straps, the 109's cramped cockpit, his heavy leather jacket, and the sun's blazing rays all seemed to squeeze him. Lifting his neck from his shoulders to look backward, he saw a sight that allowed him to breathe again. The P-40s had not followed him. Instead, they orbited in a defensive circle a mile beneath him, covering one another's tails, expecting a dogfight that was not to be. As Franz leveled off, a new wave of sickness struck his stomach. He realized he had abandoned his wingman. Worse, his wingman was his leader. Even worse, now he was alone and disoriented, easy prey should the enemy come across him. The fight had ended in mere minutes, as they did in the desert. Franz turned White 12 in the direction of Martuba. Relying on the ocean as his northern compass point and the sun as his southern point, Franz reasoned that his base lay somewhere in the middle of the horizon. The sun cooked him through the cockpit glass. He strained his eyes and felt his head grow heavy from shame. Franz shifted his weight over his parachute. He felt something wet in his seat. His first thought was that his plane had been hit and he was feeling its engine coolant. Then he touched a warm, dark patch in his crotch. He had lost control of his bladder. Franz flew until he saw the green mountains. Somewhere below, he knew, was home. Navigating in a land without forests or railroads or streets was a challenge Franz had never anticipated when he was teaching cadets to fly.
"There you are!"
Ruddle's voice squawked across the radio. Franz scanned the skies and grimaced when he looked over his shoulder toward the sun. That's where Ruddle came from, by habit. a pilot could live longer by always approaching from the sun. Ruddle pulled up on Franz's left wing, the wingman spot. Ruddle could tell that Franz was scared by the way he flew, his plane bobbing and jittering.
"You lead,"
Ruddle told Franz, and gave him a heading. Franz preferred to follow, but obeyed orders, and flew onward until glints of light blinked below from the arid earth. Squinting, Franz saw small planes lined up along a desert airfield. They were home. Franz landed first, and Ruddle second. Franz shut his own engine down and remained in his cockpit. The canopy flipped open. Closing his eyes, he leaned his head against the sweat-covered leather seat back. Lifting himself from his plane, Franz saw ground crewmen approaching, so he hurried away, scurrying for his tent, hoping to dodge any embarrassment at the sight of his wet pants.
"Stiegler!"
Ruddle shouted from behind. Franz stopped and approached Ruddle, head hung, bracing for a verbal lashing. But instead, Franz was met by a grin.
"Today was a success,"
Ruddle said.
"You survived. You brought yourself home. And if you think about it, you'll never be that scared again for the rest of your life."
"I'll confirm your victory, sir,"
Franz said.
"But first I need to change my pants."
Many times pilots came home, myself included, and we had to change our pants, Franz would remember. And not just when we were new to combat. Ruddle laughed and slapped Franz on the shoulder.
"You aren't the first one that's happened to."
Franz opened the flap to his tent. A blast of heat hit his face. He flopped onto his cot, closed his eyes, and fell into an instant sleep. In the evening he went to the mess tent. He passed through the line and saw that dinner was the same as lunch. A tin of Italian beef his comrades called Mussolini's ass. Back home, Franz had been picky and would tell his mother, "I'll pass on anything that flies or swims." Little did he know how much he would come to regret those words. Franz sheepishly sat apart from Ruddle and the others. Before every bite, he tried to swap the flies from his food. Sneaking a glimpse at the other pilots, he saw that they ate without brushing away the flies, swallowing a few with each gulp of the tough, sticky meat. Franz was only a few clean bites into his meal when Ruddle stood and announced, "Fire free!" Franz looked at Ruddle, aghast, his fork frozen in midair. Ruddle saw Franz's wide eyes and full plate, then shouted a line he would use at every meal after that, needed or not.
"Fire free, except for Stiegler."
The other pilots laughed. A few whacked Franz on the back with friendly slaps as they departed. With relief, Franz finished his dinner in solitude, but knowing he was no longer alone. The P-40 that Ruddle had downed was the only German victory in Africa that day, but the rudder of Ruddle's 109 remained unmarked. 5. The Desert Amusement Park. 9 days later, April 18, 1942. The sun blazed through the canvas of Franz's tent. His watch read just after 4 p.m. Franz lay on his cot, trying to read the only book he had brought to the desert besides his Bible. It was about the lives of the Catholic saints, the heroes of the church. Sweat fell from his forehead and onto the pages. Franz mopped his brow frequently. The flies bothered him more than the heat. They buzzed around his head no matter how hard he swatted them. The more he read, the more Franz was bothered by the hypocrisy of the war he had joined, of people who believed in the same God fighting one another. A persistent sound outside his tent distracted Franz. First Group's squadrons 1, 2, and 3 were throwing a party in their tent cities to celebrate the one-year anniversary of their time in the desert. Franz had no intention of going to the party, although First Group had invited all the other squadrons and anyone who served at Martuba. A tap on the fabric of Franz's tent interrupted his self-pity. Franz looked up as Lieutenant Ferdinand Fergel thrust his face inside, his dark, narrow eyes scanning the room and his thin lips curled in a mischievous smile. They called Fergal the Birdman, because Vogel means bird in German. Shrewd yet likable, Fergal was an Austrian and one of Squadron 4's top flight leaders. Fergal was also the squadron's black sheep, because he had black hair, black eyes, and a tendency to be dark-minded and quirky. Franz had yet to fly with Fergal, but he snapped upward on his cot as the officer entered. After 7 months in the desert, Fergal had scored 2 kills, on top of his 4 victories from the Battle of Britain. Like Franz, Fergal wore a light tan shirt and shorts, but instead of boots, Fergal wore sandals with socks.
"The squadron's going to the party," Fergal said. "You're coming with us."
"Would that be right, sir?"
Franz asked. "I haven't been here long."
"You've flown in combat, yes?"
"Yes, sir. Once."
"Then get up," Fergal said. "You're one of us."
Franz obeyed and followed Fergal outside. The two quickly caught up to the rest of Squadron 4 as the pilots walked toward the sounds of revelry. Ruddle was already there, somewhere in the thick of the fun. A circle of tents and booths had been erected in the center of the squadron villages. A sign greeted them: "Welcome to Neumann's Desert Amusement Park." Franz had heard of Captain Adu Neumann, First Group's colorful and beloved leader, more a father figure than commander. This party was his idea. If Franz had not known that he was sober, he would have sworn that he was drunk. Barrel-chested tankers and tired infantrymen representing the Afrika Corps had turned out, as well as mechanics in their greasy coveralls and even Stuka dive bomber pilots. The festival's soundtrack boomed from a band of tankers loaned by the Afrika Corps. Franz tapped his hand on his thigh to the lively tuba and accordion beat and wished he had brought his own accordion from home. His mother had made him take lessons. A clanking, creaking old convertible rolled past, honking its horn. The car teemed with pilots who waved from the back seat, mimicking royalty. They wore pots on their heads, furs, fezes, grass skirts, and goggles, their best imitation of lunatics. The vehicle had been hauled from a junk pile and brought to life again. Officers and enlisted men alike waited in long lines to ride in it. Neumann had instructed his men to let off steam, to be eccentric, and to forget where they were for one night. They took his words to heart. Neumann's group had been the first to arrive in Africa. They had Marseille and more aces than any other group due to timing and Neumann's leadership. He was an ace with 13 victories, but he led better from the ground, coaching, analyzing tactics, and planning missions. He knew when to push his men to bring out their best, and when they needed a break. As Franz and the others strolled through the grounds, they saw pilots riding a flimsy merry-go-round brought in from a coastal city. Others waited before food stands that served tin cups of red wine and sausages flown in from Germany. Men bowled, knocking pins into the sand at homemade bowling lanes. The crack of rifles rang from men shooting at targets against a sand dune backdrop. Squadrons battled each other in a tug-of-war for a bottle of French cognac, and on a sandhill mechanics competed for the title of strongest man in a King of the Mountain-styled game called Knock Lucas Down. On the fringe of the party, Franz saw Neumann's famous headquarters, a circus wagon. The wagon rode atop 4 massive wheels. Neumann had first located the wagon while flying in the Battle of France, where the wagon had been abandoned by its traveling circus. Somehow, Neumann managed to have it shipped to Africa. The wagon had large windows with brightly colored shutters, and the words "Neumann's Colorful Cabaret" were painted on its sides in tall letters. Franz had never been inside, although he had heard stories that Neumann had a painting of naked native girls, and above each girl he had scrawled a pilot's name upon the man's entry to his unit. With each victory, Neumann would have his orderly paint a grass palm frond on the grass skirt of the pilot's girl. A horn's bellow brought the games to a halt. Neumann appeared and stood on a stage of crates. Dressed in his desert fatigues, the captain wore his black hair cropped short. He had calm blue eyes. His chin was small, and when he smiled, he scrunched his face in a happy, unassuming grin.
Nowhere has it been demonstrated more plainly that no one person can survive without the other, as it has here in the desert.
Neumann called out.
Nowhere is the esprit de corps more important than here.
The crowd bellowed a shout of agreement.
Today is therefore declared a day of merriment,
Neumann shouted.
Today you can and should all paint the town red.
Applause echoed between the bluffs. Neumann's men loved him. He was to JG-27 who Rommel was to the Afrika Corps. Everyone called Neumann Edu, a short clipping of his name, Eduard, although few knew his story. As a boy, Neumann had been orphaned and raised by his grandmother. His lonely upbringing imparted him with a sensitive demeanor, perhaps the very reason he was able to control Marseille and mold him into JG-27's finest fighting weapon. As the sun set, the men congregated on a hill to watch a variety show. At the back of the audience, Lieutenant Schreur served as the show's MC and narrated a play-by-play over a loudspeaker from a booth made of crates. A sign painted over his head identified his station, Radio Martuba. Behind Schreur, technicians adjusted glowing radio dials to transmit his radio show to nearby units. On the stage made of sand, pilots tried their hand at comedy, and soldiers tried theirs at vaudeville. Between acts, Schreur spouted dirty jokes. Neumann introduced Captain Mock, who presented Mock's World Show, a series of skits acted out by airmen dressed like belly dancers. The audience roared with laughter. At the climax of the show, Neumann took the stage wearing a genie costume and performed a slapstick magic show set to Schreur's music. A screeching sound from the